Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Jessica Noble. She's a tech lead and engineering manager at Wayfair. Welcome, Jessica.
Thanks, Jen. I'm happy to be on your podcast.
Yeah, I'm absolutely happy to have you, excited to get going with the questions. So how about we start at the beginning with kind of what you do at Wayfair? What's it like being an engineering manager at Wayfair, and what the favorite part about your job is?
Yeah, sure. So I've been at Wayfair for about 4.5 years now. I'm currently the tech lead for the homepage team, and I manage the engineers on both the homepage team and the navigation teams. So those are two of our storefront pods. Pods are what we call teams here. And the storefront team is responsible for everything customer facing on our website. So everything from when you first hit the homepage and you're starting to click around through our categories and inspirational content, all the way to when you complete your checkout and your payment is processed, and then also our help pages and sort of customer service related customer facing features.
Got it. Yeah. And we were chatting a little bit earlier when I asked about how I should introduce you, about how things work a little bit, that titles might work a little bit differently at Wayfair than they do in other places. And I found that really interesting. So you were saying something about how everyone's kind of considered an engineer until they're a director. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So we don't have necessarily formal titles. So if you look in our org browser, is like our internal organization directory, you'll see that within our engineering part of the organization, everyone is called engineer pretty much until they reach the director level, and the directors are responsible for entire departments, essentially, or larger groups of teams. Until then, like, our managers are still considered engineers. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're actively coding every day, but they're responsible for the architecture and sort of roadmap decisions for the people who work on their teams. Mm-hmm. So some of those people are managers. Some of those people are just very technical programmers who are responsible for larger architectural decisions, but everyone is still considered a quote-unquote engineer.
Got it. And so what about your role? You know, if you were to kind of break it down for, in terms of like percentage that you spend on like people management kinds of things versus that you spend more on technical kinds of issues, how would you break that down?
Between people management and more technical concerns, I'd say I'm probably 50-50. Mm-hmm. I spend about half of my week in one-on-ones, more like coaching conversations, growth conversations with my people, and the other half, not necessarily coding, but meeting with stakeholders, determining specs, and doing sort of more the tech lead role of my team, also breaking down projects into individual tickets, scoping the amount of work, being able to give broad estimates for our product partners, and driving sort of the roadmap decisions and this is really awkward.
I totally get it. Okay. I mean, it totally makes sense.
Assisting on more of the broader like architectural direction of my team.
Got it. That totally makes sense. And from what you can tell, is that kind of a typical breakdown for someone in your role who's kind of like that manager role, who would be called a manager, say, if they didn't work at Wayfair, like a 50-50 kind of split? Or is it really kind of team-based or pod-based?
Yeah, it's definitely based on the pod. So I mentioned that I am the tech lead and manager of the homepage team, but only the manager for the members of the navigation team. And that's because one of my reports just became a tech lead a few months ago for the navigation team. So he's responsible still for the technical direction, partnering with our product manager and sort of driving the roadmap and architectural decisions for that section of the code base. But he doesn't directly manage humans.
Okay. That's cool. And, you know, just kind of getting back to this idea that everyone's an engineer until they're a director, because the directors are in charge of, you know, entire departments. Because it's just really interesting, and I'd love to get your take on it. Like, is it a cultural thing? Do you feel like it's good, bad, otherwise, to be called just, oh, we're all engineers here, and we all just kind of wear slightly different hats, versus, you know, so that kind of approach, does that come from kind of the Wayfair philosophy and the Wayfair culture, versus like the approach of, you know, giving everybody a more defined job title?
So I think that the sort of ideal cultural direction that we would want people to sort of interpret that decision would be that titles aren't necessarily the only way to grow your career, that all of us, we try to maintain a sort of flatter hierarchy in our culture, and that an engineer, whether they've been here for a few months or several years, both have both have value, and their voices are important, and that you shouldn't be able to pull rank essentially in a conversation in order to get things done. And obviously, we do have levels within that, and like a clear growth for people who want to continue building their skills and increasing their scope, and in general, taking on larger and larger responsibilities. But as you mentioned, like that's just a different hat. Necessarily, it's not that like those people are better or worse. It's just that they're doing different work at a different scope.
Got it. And so you mentioned growth and career growth. So it sounds like it's a really great culture for that kind of finding your place within your career and getting that career growth. So that sounds really awesome.
Yeah. Growing engineers, especially new engineers, is something that's really important to us. When I started about 4.5 years ago, the engineering team was maybe a couple hundred people. And I think as of now, there's about 1,200 people. So
let's put this in context. Just putting that in context, that like just the engineering team is 1,200 people.
Yeah, just the engineering team is 1,200 people.
Yeah.
So obviously, and most of those people who we've brought on are brand new engineers, entry level, most, I'd say, right out of college. So this is not just their first engineering job, or they're brand new to Wayfair. This is their first job. So being able to quickly onboard people, train them on what it's like being a full-time engineer in the workplace, and then also ramping them up to our own systems and processes and best practices and way of doing things is very important to us. And it's something that we've had to scale very quickly in the last couple of years. And that's something that I really love doing. I love ramping up brand new engineers. About a year ago, I transitioned from being an IC myself to being a manager. And I had two, what we call labsters. So Wayfair Labs is our onboarding process for entry-level engineers. I had two labsters on my team. Since then, I've taken on two more labsters and then one returning intern. And so most of my team started as very junior, and it's fantastic to watch them transition into fully onboarded engineers who are growing in their scope and taking on bigger and bigger challenges.
It is. It's so rewarding to be able to see that, to see the fruits of your labor from a kind of a more selfish perspective, but you know, it's like, hey, wow, I helped this to happen. But also just seeing, you know, where they're going, and the more that they learn and grow, the more you do as well. So it's absolutely reciprocal. So that's awesome. And that's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Jessica, was essentially talking about that transition and that growth from being an individual contributor to being more of a manager, having more of a leadership role. So because you've been someone who's done that yourself and who's also been really, really passionate about helping others to do that, what kinds of advice would you give to folks who are wanting to make that transition from being an individual contributor to, say, more of a manager or leadership role?
I would say that the first thing you have to do is accept or come to terms with the fact that you are essentially an entry level in this new role that you're taking on, that being a manager is a completely different set of skills than those that you have probably proven yourself to be pretty good at if you're being promoted to management. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is, prioritizing learning of these new skills. So that's plugging into as many voices as you can, find a mentor, find a cohort of other new managers that you can use as a support group to troubleshoot any problems, conflicts, rough times that you're experiencing on your team, reality check any of your assumptions, and just generally support one another through the process. And then also plugging into as many resources as you can, whether that's blogs or leadership books or online communities, just to make sure that you are gaining the experience of people who have been doing this for much longer than you, because you are brand new at this role.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of so being humble a little bit, that like don't assume going into it that you know how to, that you have the skills and that you have the systems in place in order to do it, because most likely you don't. And if you go in with that assumption. Yeah.
And then,
Go ahead.
Oh, and then also like, I think that it's really important in that respect too, is that you need to shift your focus of what you consider your own output on the team. So up to that point, before you become a manager, you might be responsible for larger projects that other people work on, but you're still primarily focused on the code you write, the decisions you make, the your own personal technical output on the team. And now as you shift more into a management or leadership role, you're responsible for the output of your entire team, the well-being and development of your entire team. And usually if you have to make the decision of, I could do this task, or I can train someone else to be able to make these decisions and do these tasks, it's a much higher leverage decision to do the training, even though it's maybe a little bit harder and the decisions won't be the same as the ones that you made.
Mm-hmm. Sort of trusting that they'll be okay, that they'll do it. They may not do it the way that you would have done it, but it's still going to get done. And that's about that collective output. Yep. I like that. I like thinking about it that way, that it's not just about your individual output. It's about the teams. It's about the entire team and the responsibility for the entire team. Yeah. And that's a hard shift for a lot of people to make.
Yeah, definitely. I remember when I first shifted, I was still picking up tickets on my team at the time, and also trying to hold weekly one-on-ones and go to all these extra meetings and monitor the progress of the tickets that the rest of the people on my team were completing, and also being able to coach them through their decision-making. And my tickets kept just getting carried over to the next sprint. And I'm like, maybe I should stop picking up these tickets that are blockers for my overall roadmap for the team, and just trust that I can assist other people to make their decisions faster and better, and not necessarily depend on myself to be making any code changes anymore.
Yeah, and so let's get into the weeds a little bit here, into the sense of, you know, answering tickets or like responding to tickets, because this is a topic that comes up quite a lot when I talk with folks who are, you know, new engineering managers or even seasoned engineering managers, where it's there's like this you want to jump in, right? Like you want to jump in and you want to respond to that ticket. And I think in some cases, it's like partially kind of a personal thing where it's like, oh, but this is what I'm good at and I want to, and I love doing this and this is fun. But to a certain extent, it could also be like the system or the culture or the team or the pod in your case, where it's like expected that the manager respond to some of the tickets. So it sounds like though in your case, Jess, that you had the ability to say, you know what, I'm going to delegate some of these tickets to other people. So is that kind of how you were able to work with that you had the authority to delegate those tickets? It was just getting to the realization yourself that, okay, I don't have to be doing all of these.
Right. So yeah, on my team as a tech lead, I still do have input on those tickets. I'm there in backlog grooming. I'm going to meetings with stakeholders. I'm sort of estimating how long various tasks may take when in those sort of initial conception meetings. And so I do still have sort of creative input. So as an engineer, we're makers, right? We like to invent things. We like to create something new. And shifting my understanding of like what it means to create, that I need to necessarily like put hands to keyboard to have that sort of creative input to the decisions that or to the features that my team is going to be rolling out, or the architectural decisions that they're going to be implementing, was kind of key in being okay with still considering myself an engineer, while also not being a blocker for my team because I'm picking up tickets and that I don't necessarily have time to complete.
Yeah, I love that. The shifting the definition of that you still get to create, but it's in a different way. It's through, like you were talking about earlier, like through meetings, really. You know, I mean, let's not try to make it sound sexier than it really is. It's really through meetings, right? I mean, so
yeah,
you're meeting with the stakeholders and things like that, but you're making those important decisions that can shape how the code gets written or when or how a project moves forward.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. And so speaking of meetings, kind of getting into the weeds a little bit, one of the things that I'd like to talk about is meetings and meeting frequency and things like that, because I think, you know, for a lot of managers, that's our life. That's your lives. That it's a lot of meetings. And just to some extent, it can feel like, oh, really? Yet another meeting. But I think to a certain extent, it's part of one's job as a manager, whether it's one-on-ones or whether it's the group meetings with stakeholders, whoever they may be. So what's your approach to meetings, and kind of how do you manage that?
Yeah, so I've learned to not have that sort of knee-jerk reaction that most engineers that are individual contributors have to meetings. Usually you think that when you're an IC and your output is necessarily tied to amount of time you have at your keyboard actively coding, solving those problems as you implement solutions to tickets, meetings are a distraction. It pulls you away from the thing that is the key, the core to your job. And so at that point, the only meetings that are worth it are meetings that are going to make you more efficient at doing that thing. As you move into more of a manager role, you still need to prioritize meetings, but I don't necessarily have that sort of hatred of meetings that I used to, because I think that meetings are when I do my job, whether that's backlog grooming and scoping tickets for my team in the future, whether that's one-on-one and being there to directly support my reports, whether that's meeting with stakeholders and figuring out what's coming down the pike as far as our roadmap goes in 1 month or 2 months or the next year, or just sort of information gathering meetings where I'm trying to suss out what other teams in my department are going to be working on so that we can collaborate and maybe work together on some sort of common solution. That's when I do my job. It's not a distraction from doing my job. Not all meetings are alike in quality or value. Mm-hmm. So you still have to make sure that you're only going to the meetings that are going to amplify the output of your team. Mm-hmm. But meetings, that's about all I got.
I love that amplify the output of your team. That's a good decision. If anything that will amplify the output of your team, that it's a good decision. It's a good meeting.
Yeah. And there are only so many hours in a day. So you have to kind of like use that time scarcity to even rank those meetings that may have benefit for your team. And also only go to meetings that you have adequate time to prepare for, to make sure that you're making the most out of that time.
Yeah, those are some really good meeting criteria that I had never thought about before. That do I have the time to prepare for this meeting? If not, is it actually even going to end up being useful? Because why am I here? What's the desired outcome? And so if you can't begin to mentally prepare for whatever that meeting is, or go through notes,
or do research. The pre-read, or do the research that's going to make you the most effective in that meeting, or write an agenda, then, you know, it's probably not going to be as useful as it could be. So maybe it's not the best use of your time.
Yeah, and especially if you're the one calling the meeting, I think that there's often this sort of knee jerk, we need to have a meeting. And so you just, you know, you put it in Google Calendar or whatever it is, and you say, okay, meeting Monday, 2 to 3 p.m. And then you're like, well, I'm not sure what we're going to talk about it, but I know we need to have a meeting, and I don't have time to write the agenda. But like, if you don't have time to write the agenda, then is it just going to be a waste of everyone's time, you know, calling 5, 10, or 15 people into that meeting? It can be really a reality check there for the folks who are calling the meetings.
Yeah, and I just had a pre-meeting about an hour ago for a meeting that I'm having on Monday, where there are two of us who called the meeting, and we realized that there were a bunch of things that like we needed to get on the same page about before we could even set an agenda. So we had a meeting to talk about what we were going to talk about with the larger group on Monday.
Hey, yeah, and that's cool. You know, I'm all for that. You know, a pre-meeting, or if you need two pre-meetings, fine. You know, especially if using fewer resources, right? If it's just like two or three people's time or two people's time, then call the bigger meeting where there might be 10 or 15 people there. Get all your ducks in a row first, and really make sure before you call in, you know, the engineers where the keyboard time is so important, or anyone else because you don't want to waste anybody's time. It's so important. The time scarcity piece of it is important to remember too, that there's only so many hours in the day, and that we don't all want to be working 12-hour work days. So let's protect our time.
Right. One tool we use when determining how expensive a meeting is and how valuable it would need to be is sort of estimate the number of points you would need to assign to that meeting. So if you're going to, so we use points as one point of engineering effort is 8 uninterrupted hours of engineering effort toward a project. So if you need to call a meeting with 16 engineers and it's going to be a 1-hour meeting, then that meeting needs to be more useful than a 2-point project. So that's like, how much engineering work could you accomplish if one engineer were working 2 days straight? Is this meeting more valuable than you know, a project that would take that long?
So the math there is 1 point is 8 hours of work. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's how we estimate how much time a ticket would take on a sprint.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's why you're using that particular metric there. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. So if you're calling, if there's a meeting with the, I'm just trying to understand the math here because it's really cool.
Oh,
I
yeah.
love this.
I can explain this a little clearer.
the 16
yeah,
engineers.
Yeah, so I can use 8 instead. So if you're going to take 8 engineers, or if you're going to call a meeting that has 8 engineers in it, and the meeting is going to be an hour long, is that meeting going to be more valuable than a project that one engineer could roll out if they had 8 hours of uninterrupted time?
Got it. Because it's 8 hours of people's time. Because it's eight. It's 1 hour times 8 people. Got it. Yep. Okay. And then the 16, we would multiply it by 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. That that totally makes sense. And I think that's a really great way of thinking about the value of a meeting, particularly if you're using engineers' time for it. Do you guys have sort of a, what would be the word, a way of thinking about, like, if it's not just engineers in the meeting, or are there other kinds of folks, other kinds of stakeholders or folks in other departments?
I'm thinking about sprint planning because that's a fairly frequent large meeting that my team holds. So when we do sprint planning, we look at all of the work that we want to accomplish over the next couple of weeks, and we estimate each of the tickets. At this point, they've already been fully scoped, and if you open them up, you can see all of the details of each of the tickets, and we determine how long each of those tasks is going to take, so that we can commit to that amount of work in the, over the next 2 weeks. And those meetings, we pull in not just engineers, but we also pull in our QA analysts, our web analysts who are going to be tracking customer interactions and determining whether, say, our A/B tests are successful or not. Product managers, sometimes we pull in members of the design team to talk through mocks and clarify any questions with how to handle, say, edge cases with those mocks. All of those people's time is valuable too. So you don't want to pull in anyone to that meeting who isn't going to either be able to provide value or gain value from being there, right? So if we don't have any new features that we're rolling out in a sprint, and it's mostly addressing bugs or more sort of architectural shifts, then like we don't invite the design team because they wouldn't find that time valuable.
Mm-hmm. Their time would be more valuable working on projects where it design it, right? Doing the stuff that requires the designing, as opposed to sitting in a meeting where they may not even need to play a role because there's not going to be so many design changes or something like that.
Exactly.
Cool. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's shift the conversation and talk a little bit about professional development, like your own professional development. And the reason that I bring this up, Jess, is because I know that you're very much into your own professional development, because the places where we've met in person have been essentially like professional development events.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. So how do you approach the professional development like of your career? What kinds of opportunities, resources do you seek out?
I'm plugged into a bunch of different resources, blogs, Slack communities, newsletters, and the ones that I find most valuable are the ones that highlight as many voices as possible. So I do have a few blogs that are more or less like one person's perspective, but the ones that I check the most frequently are, for example, the RANS leadership Slack that both of us are on, because that's a good place. It is a good forum for having very specific conversations about different topics within leadership. So if you are looking for interviewing advice, there's a channel where you can talk to tech leaders who are specifically interested in talking about how to interview. If you're looking for advice on how to promote diversity, you can just jump in the diversity channel and talk about those topics with engineers who are or tech leaders who are interested in that specific topic. And I find that it's a very useful way to get many perspectives on any one topic that I'm interested in. Another resource that I'm plugged into for a similar reason is the Software Leads Weekly newsletter. Mm-hmm. And this is more or less a digest of articles, TED Talks, other videos, blog posts that this organization, Software Leads Weekly, has compiled, and they send it out every Friday. And it's a nice just like quick hit of are there any sort of trending tech management articles that came out in the last week, and I can kind of read them on a Friday afternoon as I'm sort of winding down and ready to go and hit the weekend.
I believe that's Oren. Is that Oren Ellenbogen? I believe it is the Software Lead Weekly. I know that Oren Ellenbogen has such a newsletter. I'm not sure if it's Software Lead Weekly or if it's another one. I'm pretty sure it is. But yeah. Was there something else? Was there another resource?
And then besides that, I love going to sort of tech management and just tech focused meetups and conferences, especially small conferences, because it's a great opportunity to, listen to a bunch of talks from a bunch of different people who all have different perspectives, and B, network with people, you know, before and after those talks, and sort of build out your network of people that then you can, as I was mentioning before, draw on to troubleshoot your problems, reality check, and in general, discuss any sort of management ideas that you've been kicking around or thinking about or trying to implement on your teams. And it's a great idea or a great way to figure out what other people are doing, especially outside of your company, because sometimes within your company, it can become a bit of an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to find out what other companies are doing, what other people are trying.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you find the signal in the noise, so to speak? Because when I think about some of these resources, which I follow as well, you know, the RANS Leadership Slack, Software Lead Weekly, going to meetups and reading other kinds of newsletters and stuff, there can be a sense of information overload, whether it's, oh my goodness, there's like 10 links here and I have like 10 minutes, which one do I click on to read, or like going to a conference, especially if it's a bigger one, but even if it's a smaller one, it can get overwhelming in terms of the amount of information and the amount of people. So how do you approach that to make sure that you're not like overloading your brain with too much information and really kind of finding the valuable stuff?
I'd say I do a little bit of random sampling.
Okay.
So when I have time, I will go and check these blogs, check the different channels in RANS Leadership Slack, read the articles that Software Leads Weekly has sent out. I might spend maybe half an hour to an hour clicking through resources and generally absorbing the information. But the way that I kind of filter that information is generally by how applicable it would be or how willing I am to make a change or adjust my perspective with regard to my team. Because if it's not, you know, directly applicable to where I think my team is currently or like what would be a reasonable thing to try out at my company, then it's, you know, as good of an idea as it might be, it isn't necessarily worth digging into at this time. Mm-hmm. And then besides that, like, often there is sort of repeat advice between articles, but hearing, like, different ways of phrasing it is still, I think, somewhat useful if you have the time to read through, because it's going to shift maybe the vocabulary you use or the way you approach a problem, which is kind of neat.
Do you use any software tools to like Evernote or something like that, where, you know, if there's like an article where you're like, I don't want to read this now, but like you kind of save it for later, or some sort of like organizational system, given that you're, you know, you're you know, subscribed to a lot of blogs and a lot of newsletters and stuff like that. Do you have a structure or a system or software tools to kind of keep track of stuff? Or is it kind of just in the moment and it's like, oh, wow, this article looks really relevant, so I'm going to read it now?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the most sophisticated system, but I'll tell you what I do. If an article looks interesting, I'll open it up in I have two Chrome windows open. I have the Chrome window where I'm like actively doing work, and I have the Chrome window of articles I wish I had time to read.
I love it.
And so if something looks interesting, then I'll stick it in that second Chrome window.
Okay.
And when I have a spare 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'll go and read through it. And if I think that it's something that I want to remember, return to, maybe pass on to someone, I have it used to be an Evernote, but I switched over to a Google Doc because it's just a little bit easier to share with other people without giving them the ability to edit it. Mm-hmm. So I have a Google Doc of tech lead and management related articles that I have then categorized by topic so that I can go back to it, maybe send someone a link to it in the future.
That's cool. I love that. Yeah. Not super sophisticated, but sometimes the best systems are the super simple ones. Two tabs and a Google Doc. I love it.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep. I have my Chrome window of things I wish I had time to read, and I have my Google Doc of things I read that I found interesting enough to save.
Yeah. Awesome. So let's transition to the last question. And this is the question that I ask to all of my podcast guests. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
I'd say that the biggest people-related challenge that I face is managing people or interacting with people wherever they are, whether that's wherever they are in their career or the way that they enjoy communicating or their current set of problems and challenges related to their own development or the projects that they're working on. And so when I walk into a one-on-one, I try to put myself in that mindset. What are they working on? Task-wise, what are they working on sort of behavioral or growth-wise, and sort of shifting away from wherever I was previously in the meeting. I was just walking out of the problems that I'm focusing on myself and then trying to meet them where they are. And that, I think, was something I kind of learned trial and error by giving maybe some not as applicable direction or advice, just because when you first start managing new reports, it's easy to be like, well, I was successful this way, so if you do the things this way, then you could be successful too. That's not necessarily the best advice for everyone. So figuring out what motivates someone, what challenges they're facing now, and then sort of fitting your coaching mechanisms and feedback to what the next step for them would be is, I'd say, the most challenging, but also the most rewarding when you manage to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can absolutely relate to that. Really, yeah, meeting them where they are and not putting your own experiences and biases into whatever advice or resources you might share with them, because it is so easy to just kind of go back and say, oh, well, this is the way that I did it, and I found this really helpful, here, go do this. And instead, really thinking about the person's personality, and even, like you said, I like that you brought up, you know, what project are they currently working on? Where are they currently? Where is their head? Because that's where they're going to be stuck, most likely. And then if you start talking about a different project or something else, that it's going to be really hard to get them out of that. So just kind of putting that all into context. I mean, remembering all of that too, that is something that I find the most challenging. I'm sort of keeping track of where people are and what their goals are and things like that. So I found notes to be really helpful with that, you know, just even just reviewing them really quickly before a meeting So do you have, you know, is there anything that you do to kind of keep track of like where team members are, whether it's maybe a spreadsheet or notes or something like that, or some other kind of system?
Yeah, I've got a couple of tools there too. Also similarly low tech. The first would be a what we call the monthly check-in document. So it's a Google Doc where every month, roughly, sometimes it's a little bit longer than that. Every month we go through sort of a mini performance review, which sounds really scary, but when you do it every month, it becomes not that big of a deal at all. So you have to give first a self-review. So that's one thing and only one thing that you think you're doing really, really well. One thing and only one thing that you think is your next opportunity area. And then I then give that feedback to them. What's the one thing I think they're doing really well? What's the one thing I see as their next opportunity area? And then we flip it and they have to provide upward feedback, which is really intimidating, I think, to new hires when they first start. But hopefully as we build a greater trust relationship, they feel comfortable being more and more honest with one thing that they think I'm doing really well to support them and one thing I could be doing better to help unblock them, help them move faster, help them amplify their own output. Mm-hmm. And so I keep that document, and every month we push the answers from the previous month down. We review them to see what progress they've made in those areas. And then, you know, we answer those same six questions at the top of the document. And so going through that, I think, is really helpful to remember what people are working on and how they view their own growth. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, I have my notebook that I bring to every one-on-one with what we talked about, what we decided are action items coming out of that meeting, what problems they're facing in their day-to-day, and what I can do to maybe shift process or get more information for them regarding a certain topic, or in general support them better to help them move faster. And so I have that notebook separated by person so that in my notes, it's more or less a stream of every one-on-one conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. And that sort of keeps you from like, oh, I have to remember everything that we talked about. Like, nope, it's right here. My brain is in this notebook, or at least what was in my brain.
Exactly.
Is now
yeah.
In there. Yeah. And I love
that. And the second I sit down on my next one-on-one, I'm writing underneath the notes from the meeting before, just with a new date. And so it is sort of a more continual process.
Yeah, that's cool. And I love the monthly review, the monthly check-in thing too, both from it gets them kind of used to the feedback on a more continual basis, as opposed to just kind of the once or twice a year kind of thing. It also gets them used to giving feedback as well. And so that really, I think that really helps to build that trusting relationship, and okay, that this is a two-way street here, and that you can show how, you know, like if they were to give you feedback to say, okay, here's an opportunity for growth, to, you know, help me better, then you come back and actually, you know, you do something. You say, hey, you gave me this feedback and I'm going to change this. And it's like, wow, maybe, okay, I can do that too. You gave me this feedback. and so that it works both ways. I found that to be like really, really helpful in creating that back and forth two-way street.
Yeah. And on the selfish side, it gives me things to work on, gives me more immediate feedback. Early on in our relationship, obviously, they pull the punches a bit. But as you build that trust relationship, people feel more and more comfortable giving you, you know, better and better feedback, which is the only way you grow, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you mean by throat? You mean that they're hesitant, they're a little bit gun shy in terms of giving feedback, or they're just not sure how to do it in the beginning?
Probably a little bit of both. I don't think they know what they can or should suggest or ask for when I ask them how I can better support them, especially new hires. Like if this is your first job, you don't know, you don't have anything to compare your manager to. And it's not until maybe something goes wrong that you wish had gone slightly differently that you have feedback. That's just something I've noticed. But after the first like couple of months, as you start to get more of a rapport, people are more comfortable giving you better and better feedback.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And it brings me back to the days when I was kind of first starting out, first job kind of thing, even second job, where it was like I often said, I don't know what I don't know. And then I'm just kind of thinking back to, if my manager in that case had asked me to give him or her feedback, I probably would have responded in a similar way, right? Where it's like, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Everything seems fine. You're doing a great job. I'm like, that's not helpful.
Right.
I
So
mean,
what if
thank
I
you, but
told you
that's not
that?
helpful.
Right? What if I told you're doing great, keep it up? Oh, okay. Yeah. So it sort of creates that. Yeah. And the rapport, I think rapport is the key word there, right? That's definitely it's something that helps to create that and sustain that over time. Great, great. So it's been wonderful talking with you, Jessica. It's just about time to wrap things up. And so thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Great, great. I am glad to hear it. Take care.
Thanks, bye.
Okay.